Screen. That shared. This here.
Okay, shall we get started? So Thursday, bring your laptops and we'll do a Blackboard test that will be open mind and closed book. No notes or anything. So, and that. So, did you guys think about any questions from the study guide? You spent all weekend studying, right? Oh, yesterday you had a day off to study?
Absolutely.
Okay. I like that. So, when you study tonight, yeah, ask any question. So you can ask any questions that you may have now because you can't ask. Well, you can ask me on Thursday, but I won't answer unless you come before the test. So what was your?
How does the p-values work or relate to the weather modification
results? Yeah, so p-values are a statistical significance. So they measure how statistically significant something is. So, and that goes back to the hypothesis test. And usually you have something where you say, we have a hypothesis that these two data sets are the same. So usually you have a target and control, for example, and you say, oh, these two are the same, or where one has been modified and one hasn't, and you say, oh, let's assume that these are the same, and then you want to reject that hypothesis, and the p-value is how confident you are in that rejection. So you remember in science, we can't really ever prove anything. So we can usually only disprove things. Okay. So that's why we like to reject that null hypothesis, to disprove it. How confident are we? And that's what the p-value tells you. It's a there's a significance. So usually in atmospheric science, we use 95% confidence value. So that would be a p-value of 0.05. And if you calculate that as your statistical significance, you say it's only a 5% chance that these would really be from the same data set. Or there's a 95% chance that they are different. And if they are different, then you can say there could be an effect due to a weather modification on that. So it's a significance, and it tells you how confident you are in the results. So if you want some new technology, I've been talking to someone yesterday. They got a new method for doing some area applications to enhance precipitation. So the question is, how confident are you that that new technology will work? And one way is with a significance test. So that's why it's a confidence in that. That's how it rates the weather modification. And so a lot of the analysis, we want to get to that level. And usually you can get to that with better cases and more cases, but you need a whole lot. Does anybody remember in a paper that I made you read for Thursday what the significant values were? No, that wasn't a question, I don't think. Just wanna, we did eight different cases or eight different counties. I think one or two of them had a significance of 0.05, but that was when we analyzed 40 years of data.
So if we had like a p equals 0.1, that would be only a 10% or a 10% chance.
You would have a 10% chance that they would be the same.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's, you know, so you really want to come up and say something like, you know, and when you say that a significance variable. I think, you know, these two data sets are not the same with a p-value of 0.04, so that there's only that type of significant level, 4%, that they would happen to be like that by chance.
That you could not project them all.
Yeah. So,
and is that decided before the experiment or after the data is analyzed, or both?
Both, because it's not a hard and fast rule, right? Because, you know, there's nothing special about, well, besides the 95% is two standard deviations, but there's nothing magical, there's nothing about that, right? If you got something at 6%, you know, how much worse is that? It's 1% worse, you know? So, and so sometimes we can modify it by saying, oh, we'll take a significance of 0.1. Okay. So, it, you know, it's kind of a standard acceptable level that a lot of people will take, but some people take 0.1, 0.05, you know, some take 0.1, some take very high p-values too. So it's the concept that you should really understand is that we really can't say, you know, that we proved that this worked. All we've done is, it's very unlikely that they're not the same, but then the other question would be is how, what else could have caused that? So just because, you know, you do that, that doesn't prove a cause and effect relationship. So that's one of the questions is, you know, you still have to think about why one would cause the other.
The question, talk about operational program locations. Are you going to ask, well, rather those two areas or the eight mechanics that were
in the paper, them were based upon the North Dakota county areas, but this District 1, District 2, the different counties. I want to be that specific. Know if it's in the Western North Dakota, Eastern North Dakota, you know, not specifically the area, you know, but generally you should know something like we're not seeding all of North Dakota. And they do change. If you look at the reports, so that's one of the problems we have is that sometimes the counties join and then they stop. And there's actually two counties that have dropped out. So I want to do a study to compare what happens between when they were in the program and when they weren't. See if we can see any change between that thing, because then you got the same area, but the problem is the storms and stuff would not necessarily be the same. But you should be able to get something in the terms of what you have, but do you have enough years of data? Because if you just have 1 year, right, just maybe a typically drought year or so, you can't really rely on that. So you really have to average over a long period of time, and that's the problem. It's that precipitation is so variable. So other questions? I answer all the questions.
Yes, keep going.
What do you want us to know about the statistical evaluation methods? Just like the names of different ones or how they work?
Kind of like the homework assignment in terms of, you know, difference between what type of statistical ones are there. Anybody remember the types of statistical evaluation methods? I mean, this goes back to the paper and the homework problem.
There's one about non-parametric.
Yeah, non-parametric and parametric. So that was talked about in the lecture. So them are big words. The parametric statistical tests have the underlying assumption that they're random. And that, they're a Gaussian random type of distribution. So the parametric test, the non-parametric tests are ones where you don't really need to know the underlying assumptions of how something like precip. So we evaluated precipitation in North Dakota. So if we use a non-parametric test, then we don't have to make assumptions that it's a nice Gaussian distribution of precipitation and that it's not random. And it doesn't have to be a totally Gaussian type of distribution, if that makes sense. So that's the parametric test. Or have a influence on your results. the Amada types. There's some other tests, right? There's the black box and the physical. I know what the like the black box type of test is. Yeah. So this goes back to your assignment. When we look at the statistics and you have, you know, if we're just looking at the output of the precipitation and we separate them into seed and non-seed target areas, we really don't look at what goes on in the process. You know, we didn't really look at, well, how well did they seed? Did they seed every storm? Did we have the storms then produce precipitation in that area? How did it produce the precipitation? So that's why, you know, it's a little bit of a, you know, it's not causality proof because there could be other reasons for that. So remember there was the one in my lecture. Remember, what are the two things that are, what's a very highly correlated parameter to when people eat a lot of ice cream? You think temperature. So temperature, if it's warm outside, you eat a lot of ice cream, right? So what does temperature correlate with? Summertime, sunshine. So does that mean sunny days cause people to consume ice cream? Well, they want to do it then, but that's not a cause. It's not a causation. They both vary together. So two things happen for some underlying reason. It's a nice day, so the temperature is warm, and then but this, I guess the other way to look at it is you could say warm temperatures do not cause a lot of consumption of ice cream, although it's the choice. The another one is you could correlate stream flow to like the stock market. Take the Missouri River. You might see a high correlation, but how does the stock market price actually control the stream flow? So that causation is not there. And people will imply that. You know, we seeded and then it, and we had this much precipitation. Well, both facts are true. You could be seeding in the area and it could precip, but that doesn't necessarily mean one caused the other just because they happen at the same time. Other questions?
Yeah, when you look at the cost and benefits, do you want us to know specific numbers or just that, like the benefits to the
spirit? Oh, have some ranges of numbers. So, you know, not the particular numbers, but at least the ratios. And, you know, some ballpark values of them. So I always like to do factors of 10. So, you know, if you're off by more than the order of magnitude, that would be the idea. So you want to know approximately, but not the specific number, because if you want a specific number, you know, that's what you got to go look up. You know, anybody know the mercury weight of hexane? That was on my undergraduate chemistry text. It's 69. I'm not sure why in the world I should know that. Anything, I can just go look it up in a table. But you should really know what mercury weight is and stuff. So orders of magnitude, know that there's a big cost benefit. So good multiple choice question of what it would be. So that's how I write that up. So when you study, you should write up the test question. So don't write a question, what is the cost of the North Dakota project? It's, you know, what's the cost benefit ratio approximately for the North Dakota project, or water modification crowd seeding projects in general? Hey.
Do you ever use insurance data to calculate the effect of water modification, especially for hail suppression?
Yes. That's a short answer. The problem with that, let me say this a couple ways. Alberta Calgary project is paid for and funded by the insurance companies. Okay. So they have looked at that in detail. Some of the problems with doing an open review of that is the insurance companies don't want us to give out that data. And maybe it's not that they don't want to, it's how they are able to, in some sense. I don't know that they're not exactly not restricted from giving it out, but it's probably a little bit more work than you would think to make that available. It's kind of the same thing, like, knowing how much wind turbines produce for power. So we talked about aircraft icing, right? So you can ice up your airplanes blades. What about the wind turbine blades? Or fly over some of the big wind turbine farms. Well, wouldn't they ice up too? What do? They got to shut off the wind turbines, because if they get ice, they'll throw that ice away. It'll degrade the performance. So they can't operate it in icing conditions, just like you can't fly in severe icing conditions unless you have the appropriate equipment, right? So they shut down the wind turbines. How much does that cost for the companies? So the company, to get that, you know how much icing happens, but you got to get from the company how much they are losing for that. And that's data they're not too anxious for people to know. So we have an estimate, we have an idea of that, but because they actually have to file that in loan applications. So they do put an estimate in there. But it's hard sometimes to get that type of data. But the insurance companies will do that estimate. And they have done some. And they do have a factor that you can put in, for example, the crop damage and stuff. So they have done a report for North Dakota also, for the people that work at NDSU and the people that understand the crop insurance industry and work at that.
Going through the aerosol PowerPoint, reference the size of particles graph.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you were going to be asking questions on the exam about that. What kind of questions would you ask? What, how specific?
Oh, how specific, huh? Well, I would think you should know There's different modes of the particles. There's three different modes of the aerosols that are in different size ranges. Know the approximate size of the particles. Maybe relative to something else, like the wavelength of light. And I'll probably be a little bit unfair with that question because I'll probably expect too much. But the different modes come from different sources and sinks. So it'd be nice to know the sources and sinks, particularly for the accumulation mode, because the sink is the precipitation. Okay.
What do you mean by sink?
The removal. So removal mechanism. So there's a source of the particles, and then there's a removal or a sink in the atmosphere. So the so in that diagram, there's sources of the particles, like coagulation. Of the small particles give you the accumulation mode particles. That's the source. So that's what provides it. And if it doesn't continuously build up in the atmosphere, something has to remove it, right? Think of your bank account, right? If you just have checks going into your bank account, it'll just continuously rise. So the sink is what you take the money out for. So the sinks are precipitation. So that's one thing. Knowing some of the examples of the sources and sinks, knowing that there's three modes of the aerosols. The accumulation mode particles are the ones that typically form a lot of the crowd droplets, because it's high enough number concentration of them to give you lots of particles. They last a long time in the atmosphere. What else should I ask about that?
And just to be clear on that, but all condensation nuclei are greater than 10 nanometers, right?
That's what we could, we define condensation nuclei or Aiken mode. They're really all aerosols, you know, because although in some technical terms, you know, again, it's where it really starts, but basically 10 nanometers is where you can consider that the aerosol start. And then they can get very big, but if they're really big, they just fall out, right? So a baseball wouldn't be an aerosol because if you throw it, it just falls to the ground right away, right? So so the point is you want to know that they stay there, and the idea is you got to know what the background is. And that's some of, and we can measure that. That's like this new technique. They want to put in ions into the atmosphere to help with the precipitation process. But what's the existing concentrations of them? And where do they exist? How do you measure them so that you know what you're changing? So even if you don't have all the details, you can kind of know the general process of what we think is happening. So that's why we're trying to explain why we put these particles in the atmosphere. That we want to seed with. We want to put particles that don't exist so that they do something that existing particles don't do. Let's make it rain or suppress the hail. Okay, did I pass the test? More questions?
One question kind of leading off that, I guess. So the threshold temperature is a one particle of 10,000 will produce an ice crystal. And nuclei concentration are generally less than 1,000 per cubic meter at minus 20 degrees Celsius. But does that mean that about one in every 10 cubic meters will produce an ice crystal at that threshold temperature? That sounds kind of low for like a rainstorm, but maybe it's not. Or are those two not really related like that?
Good question. Well, yeah, so it's a threshold temperature, which is kind of the start of something. It's not where it's very effective. So if you just were right at the threshold, you can start to see and have them think, but you want to be a lot colder, a lot beyond the threshold. I'm trying to think of an analogy that might make that clear. So that's why, you know, we typically are not forming clouds and having a lot of ice produced, for example, right at the threshold temperature. Okay, that's where you might get a little bit of ice. It might be the other reason why you get, you know, you don't have a whole lot of ice is because you're just beyond where you start to form the ice, it takes a while. So yeah, the idea is that maybe there's a few natural particles occurring that would form the ice, but it's not very efficient at that threshold temperature. So if you have something with a lot lower threshold that is very active at that, would really help. So I think you're right. It's a pretty inefficient ice formation mechanisms right at that threshold temperature. That's why you really don't want to see with AGI at like minus 5. You want to be quite a bit colder than the threshold temperature and that. So that makes sense in terms of that.
Kind of going off of that then. Do we know, like, when an ice crystal forms, about how much, like, I guess, water it takes out of a, like, its kind of area?
Oh.
So if you're able to drop, like, an ice crystal that you knew would form a water droplet into, like, a cloud, like, a bunch of dots, and you can suck a bunch of those dots out, how big of an area does that ice crystal kind of consume water from?
It gets a lot of water from the near environment as the short answer, but the idea is that the environment is very turbulent. It moves around. So what I think the better way to ask that question, because it's so turbulent, it makes it so quickly. And it takes it in terms of, you know, I may deplete this droplet very close by, but then other things come in and that's depleting a close area relatively quickly in terms of its lifetime of this particle. But then a lot of the air mixes and a lot of water vapor comes in. Probably talk about it later in terms of how much water does a storm actually remove from the atmosphere. So you can think of the whole storm. Okay, how much water that exists in the atmosphere is that storm actually moving? So the answer is it's not that much. It's on the order of 1 to 10%. So it's not like the whole area that you have the storm that you remove that moisture from. So a very efficient storm would remove maybe upwards of 10% of the actual water in the vapor phase. So it's relatively small. You're not removing all of it, not drying out the air. So I guess the short answer is there's lots of water vapor for it to pour on. So you really don't deplete it. However, you can in small vocal ways.
Is that 1 to 10% also true for snowstorms as well as thunderstorms?
Yeah, I think the snowstorms are probably the best. Let's see what it is. And then a lot of that is long range transport too. But there's some, well, particularly the snowstorms. It's, you know, a lot of ocean water and stuff. So you can actually look at the type of water is and where it comes from. And on a P3 aircraft, we have ones that will actually distinguish how much water is in the ice and vapor phase, where it comes from by looking at isotopes. So them are different. Types of water molecules. All right, other questions that you haven't came up with? I want to ask that question about how much you deplete, but we'll probably talk more about that later once we start forming the crowds and stuff too. Okay, we've passed your test. I gotta take my exam, right? Make sure I can do it in 45 minutes. I usually don't do that, but at least for these ones. Yeah, this is gonna be mostly a lot of multiple choice. You see ranges of numbers. Let's see how the other ones go. In terms of the other questions. And then if you get confused on it, probably can't tell you what a non-parametric test is, but we give you some hints on. So a lot of it's vocabulary, making sure you know the terms we used. P-values, terms, so it's some, but it's really applied in, but you can apply them terms and know the concepts. So, and then, okay. I asked at the end if you got any more questions, but I had a couple of things to talk about. Oh, yeah. One of them is if maybe you guys, some of you have heard, they did post the applications for the internship for the North Dakota project. And you can try this link. It's on my, so this is the web page. Sorry. Here. So, you know, go to the website. Maybe I should put it up in a link. Maybe I'll do that after class. But I posted it under today's North Dakota Internship Hire Listings. And you can go to the CLEAR page for the North Dakota site and put in water resources, because it's under the Department of Water or something at the state level. I forget the official term. So you can do that. You should find that. And the applications are due March 6th. So that's only like 2 weeks, right? Because it's 28th. So it's probably 2 weeks from yesterday, I would guess it. There's only 28 days in February, which is, there's a 22nd. So you got two more weekends to put all your stuff in there. And so apply and see how it goes. But after you study for the test on Thursday, do well on a test first and then apply. And I think they have some questions you got to answer. So if you have any questions about that, I may be able to talk to the people that posted it, if it's not clear, or get them to advise something. And maybe we could try to get it sometime. I've flown with a lot of UND pirates over the years. And stuff. So in 5 or 10 years, if you still do the flying, maybe you'll fly a Research King here and we can go and study the clouds. Okay. I wanted to get through. I was hoping that this wouldn't take so long, but maybe I'll just cover one lecture today. So this won't be specifically on the exam this time, but we're going to talk about droplet growth and ice crystal growth, which we talked a little bit about before in terms of factors that affect the growth of the droplets. So we talked about the nucleation, the initial formation of the particles. Now we want to talk about the growth of the particles, how they get bigger. And there's two things the scientists have devised. One is curvature, and the other is how the soluble materials inside the droplets. So the droplets, I put in here, grow when there's more water vapors at the surface that go into the droplet than escape. Okay, so it's a subtlety, but the idea is that it's an equilibrium. And so at the very surface, there's always a bunch of water droplets that go out to the vapor phase and a bunch that come in. So we want more coming in than going out. Okay, so that is not equilibrium, it's growing. Okay. What we need to do is get that to happen, and that's can be affected by the curvature. So equilibrium vapor pressure by a factor of 1/r. So as the droplets get bigger, the vapor pressure, it's just easier for the droplets come the water come in. Or the other way is more probably better to think about it. The small droplets have a difficult time keeping from evaporating. Right? So there's a lot that want to go out. So so if you got a small one, there's a bunch of these particles that will escape to the environment and rest of them that will come in. So it's harder to keep them. So one of the big conclusions that we want to do is that larger droplets make better cloud condensation nuclei. So the bigger the particles are, they got a bigger size, and so they have a head start on forming the droplets. Okay. And that was goes back to the aerosols. If we have less of them in the atmosphere. So one of the things we try to do is we got a lot of accumulation mode aerosol in terms of number, but not a lot of these larger than a micron in size. So if we could put these into the atmosphere, then that will form more droplets and then you can grow them larger. And there's an equilibrium. You don't want them too large because they fall right away out of the atmosphere. So 6-8 microns in size is a good size for salt particles. And this is one reason that precipitation over the oceans are very efficient. There's a lot of sea salt, which is very big particles. So don't try to do a weather modification project over the ocean. Probably there's no reason to have rain over the ocean, but it's also very efficient to do that. So very efficient process there. The other effect is what's the dissolved substances in the water. So what was the vapor pressure required for equilibrium? So think of it as if you got more of these particles in there, it kind of holds the water molecules in there better. Okay, it's harder for the water particles to escape. One of the things you could think of is, you know, if you have some of these particles on the surface, the water molecules will hit it and stay in the droplet. Okay, so typically the salt will keep the water molecules in the droplets. That's the vapor pressure in kind of in the atmosphere at the surface of the droplets. So vapor is gas. So it's a gas pressure. And equilibrium is how much you have equal amounts of the molecules going in and out of the droplets. Yes. And then we have this concept of supersaturation. That's how much we're above the 100% saturation value. Okay, saltier, more dissolved material in there. You know, you need less of a supersaturation to keep
into the keep the droplet from evaporating to survive. So it doesn't survive when it evaporates, it loses water molecules.
So the droplets will grow when the vapor pressure is decreasing or increasing, because that's the greater compression of the vapor pressure.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like vapor pressure outside equilibrium vapor pressure. It's got to be at least equal for the droplet to survive. But if the equilibrium pressure drops even lower, then basically it has extra vapor pressure so it can grow.
Pushing stuff into
the droplet.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good to me.
I guess it depends on the frame of reference that you're looking at.
Yeah. Is it
the size of the droplet increases the equilibrium pressure, right? The bigger the droplet is, the more vapor pressure has to be around the ether on.
No, I think it's the reverse. Equilibrium vapor pressure is where you have equal amounts going in and out. So if you press the equilibrium pressure, you know, so.
So the equilibrium
is where you got where it's not evaporating and not growing. So you can think of that as if you have lower equilibrium vapor pressure, that means it can survive at a lower supersaturation. It's easier for it to retain its water molecules.
So just having a lower equilibrium vapor pressure than the actual vapor pressure isn't enough for it to grow. That's enough for it to just stay alive.
It's enough for it to stay alive. The it's above its equilibrium pressure. If it's above its equilibrium pressure, it's going to accumulate. There's going to be more molecules coming in. So
it's kind of like a runaway effect. Like it gets water, pressure lowers, it gets more water, it keeps going down.
And so that's the other thing is, I don't say it here, but once it starts to grow, it will keep on growing. Okay? Because it grows and it gets bigger. Then it's easier to get more and keep it. So it's kind of like the analogy, if you have money, it's easier to make money. Right? So if you have the droplet, you get rid of it bigger, then it's easier to keep getting bigger. And so that's what we call activation. So that's what happens once it starts to grow, it just continues to grow. Okay. And the secret is, I won't ask you this, but the smaller droplets, they can start out smaller, but initially they grow faster than the big ones, because the big ones, in terms of the radius or diameter, because if you are already big, you know, it takes more molecules to get even bigger. Okay. So eventually the small ones will catch up. So as long as they're growing, they will catch up to the big ones, almost, but not quite. They narrow. Okay, so the big ones will still grow bigger, but the distance between them, you know, you have a very broad range between the biggest and smallest to begin with. And as you finally get into the crowd particles, that range has shrunk. So, the main thing is that if you got dissolved salts and stuff in there, it's easier for the droplet to maintain itself to grow bigger. So it helps. Bigger droplets, bigger curvature helps the particle grow, and also having particles in the droplets that dissolve helps it grow. And of course, the next point is that you're continuously condensing water vapor, but you're not adding any more particles, or at least not a lot of particles. So a very small droplet with a CCN on it is very salty. It's got a lot of dissolved particles in them. So so that effect becomes smaller as it grows. So you got the curvature effect becomes bigger, but the solution effects become smaller. And that's what's shown in the next diagram. Is that you have the combined effects of the temperature, you got the curvature effects. So get this right, the slope solubility effect goes down as it gets bigger. The curvature effect goes up. Okay. So these compensate. And you form a droplet, and then it grows very rapidly. So this is droplet radius here, and this is supersaturation. So this is supersaturation, or 100%. One is 100%. So once you get, so there's actually a drop where there's a water substance. It doesn't go directly from a particle to a liquid right at 100%. Okay. So that water vapor will start to condense even after, as the humidity goes up. Okay. So a lot of times you call this haze. So on a very hazy day, you have a lot of small particles, but the humidity is below 100%. So them are what we call haze particles. But above the 100%, we get to this point, and they will continuously grow to bigger particles, even though the humidity starts to fall. Okay. So this is the activation point. So you get to a point, it gets big enough that it will continuously grow, even if the humidity around the droplet will fall. And it will continuously grow, and you form these rather large droplets here of 10 microns in size. But you don't need to have that continuously increasing of the size, increasing of the humidity. So it gets complicated. But the main thing is to understand that there are two effects, and how to go for them are. The other thing that we can look at, and this goes back to why the aerosol particle size makes a difference, is this is supersaturation. So it's zero is where you're at 100% relative humidity. And if you have bigger particles, you need less supersaturation.
So the super saturations in the clouds, a lot of times this is done with the updraft velocities, how fast the air force rises. Okay, if it rises very quickly, it cools off very quickly, you get a very super saturated environment. So if you got a very vigorous storm, it's going to create huge updrafts, and you're going to activate a lot of aerosol particles. Okay, so there's plenty of particles then that are available to form the droplets. But if you got a marginal cloud and you only have a few big particles, you're not going to form a lot of the cloud particles, droplets. So that's why if we see these clouds that don't have a big updraft, you can affect them. So it's the concept of not, you can't affect something that's already going to make more of big particles. It's already efficient, it's a big storm, it's going to make a lot of large precipitation droplets. You're going to do that. That's why it's hard to stop this. I think someone at the beginning of the semester asked about suppressing wing formation. You got enough dynamics, you got enough updraft, you're going to form these particles because they're already there. So the only way to suppress it is to move that updraft or get rid of the particles. It's hard to do. It's very hard to remove the particles from the atmosphere. But we can add one pretty easily. So the big point here is that bigger aerosols, DP is the size of the aerosols, so 0.5, they require less supersaturation, less humidity, less of a vigorous storm. To make the droplets. That's why if you don't have much of an updraft, much of a system, it's really not going to make the precipitation that you want. If the cloud is, if that's the goal of the cloud, is to make precipitation. But if you get small enough, you get enough of a bigger cloud, you will form the droplets. So this gets a little bit into the cloud formation, is that rising air expansion cools. So remember, the Earth atmosphere is heated from below. It's very warm at the surface. And then as the air moves up, it cools down, and that creates the amount of humidity increases. And then these larger particles will first activate to form droplets. Oh, sorry, I got my W in there. Droplets grow. So you can have more and more droplets form, but the humidity is usually the highest near the base of the clouds. So you form a lot of droplets near the base within a couple hundred meters in terms of the number of these particles. And so once they get big enough, they continuously take up the water vapor and grow. And then, of course, it will slowly decrease the amount of water. But you don't get no bigger new particles to form. The idea is all these individual particles form near the base of the clouds. Because they have to form on the particles. So this is the growth and the formation of the clouds. So we can model, we can see
how it's different between big particles and little ones. And we try to model them, like if we put in big particles, what that does compared to what's naturally there. And that's how we can understand what would happen, because we understand how the droplets grow.
All of them long enough to store at the base of the cloud.
Yeah. In terms of the number of the particles. That's why if you want to change the number of the droplets, you need to do it near the base. That's why we base seed with the large hydroscopic seeded for us.
So just naturally clouds, I guess just forming, do they usually have enough, I guess, nuclei to form just regular, not storm clouds, just regular like fairweather cumulus, for example?
Yeah, they'll form clouds if there's some updraft, you know. And like I said, even if it's not, even if it doesn't reach 100% humidity, it still condenses some of the water onto the particles. Particles will grow, but if you, before you get to 100%, they may double or triple their size. Okay, in the clouds, they go orders of magnitude bigger. They get 100 to 1,000 times bigger. Okay, so it's a major change in the size of the drop. Okay, when you get to the high over 100% humidity. But there's always particles that will form, some of them, but how big they get and what top grade they are. If you see on my graph, it stops at about, goes to 10, I guess these are the microns, so it goes to 10 microns, but this becomes very flat. Okay, so it's very easy to form these 10 micron particles. Okay, but they're much particles in your cumulus clouds, and they don't fall, they don't precipitate. So it's easy to form these ones. But there's another process we'll talk about that will get the precipitation size particles. They have to be bigger than 100 microns to start to really fall. But there's always enough to form the clouds in terms of the typical humidities in the atmosphere, because this is not much above 100%, because this is only 100.4. It's not. The atmosphere never really gets supersaturated above 101% relative humidity in terms of water. Because there's so many particles around. But there's a lot of particles in the atmosphere. Because of all these sources. There wasn't anything put in the stuff up in the atmosphere. Have the particles, but the Earth's atmosphere has a lot of it. There's a lot of things. I need to delete that. This is the end. I should delete my other slides that I got there. My old back shirt. So. Whenever I put together new PowerPoint slides, I start with the other one. So you only really write one lecture and that's a modification for that, for the whole class. We'll stop there. But did you think of any other questions? Okay. If you do, try to email me. I'll try to answer. We could talk after class, and I will try to come early. I know that I should have this class beforehand, but I'll try to be here at least 15 minutes, 10 minutes early, so that answer a couple of quick questions.
Can we reread that one? Was that
an assignment? Well, there's indirectly, there's questions on it in terms of known types of. But I'm not going to ask you anything specific from that in terms of, I want you to generally know what the difference is between like a science-based factorial data analysis paper and one where we just quote opinions that so not in general. There won't be anything specific on that beyond the application of the concepts of parametric statistical tests. So that was a statistical analysis study. I've written papers that are physical process study papers too. Probably won't make you read all my papers that I've written. So just an example, but we're gonna ask questions. I would go over each one of the study guides, look at them and come up with questions about everyone in the topic, kind of with what you asked me. But specifically, you know, put in multiple choice answers. And how would you write a question about that? So, okay, sorry, I'll stop with